Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalka.
And this is Core Intuition. Don't overthink it.
So, Manton, I think that we need to get one of those little construction animation guys that's like perpetually digging a ditch and says under construction.
Yeah, I'll slap that on the homepage. Nice little GIF animation.
That way people will know that, you know, we're not really taking this seriously and we may never do an episode again.
While we're at it, can we have some fun and do some like MIDI background music when they load the page?
We're going to bring GeoCities back, baby. So it's been kind of a busy weekend for me. As we're recording this Monday morning, the opening weekend of One Finger Discount has just closed up.
Not One Finger Salute.
Not the One Finger Salute, although people were quick to jump to that conclusion. Kind of a wacky weekend for me. I just sort of had this idea on late Thursday. And for listeners who haven't heard about it, although I don't know how you couldn't have because everybody listening follows us on Twitter, right?
I hope so.
Pretty much they're fired from the audience if they don't.
They certainly don't follow the at Corinth because we don't actually tell anyone that we have that.
Oh, so. Yeah. We should use that, shouldn't we?
Yeah, maybe. I kind of like if they just want to follow us instead because then it's just one thing to update.
That's true. But anyway, yeah, this idea came to me last Thursday night and sort of inspired by the Mac Heist. You know, this new Mac Heist promotion is they sort of threw a curveball with, you know, normally it's just extremely cheap software, and this time it's extremely free software.
Right.
Obviously kind of a clever promotion idea on their part, and I just thought, you know, it reminds me, as usual, whenever there's a Mac Heist, it's like my sort of like stance on Mac Heist has softened a lot. I think as I see developers I know, you know, go through the process and participate, and they don't really have, they don't seem to come out of it with too negative an impression.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not for me, but I can't deny that a bunch of free apps are something that customers are into. So I just decided this time I'd try to kind of, you know, maybe piggyback on Mac Heist and get some developers together to offer a discount. And boy, did it work, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We got like more than 80 developers right now on the website, and
wow.
I imagine it's going to go up. I won't be surprised if we pass 100 here soon.
That's great. Yeah, it's been nice. My sales have sort of been going down a little bit, honestly, the last couple months where I haven't done an update, especially to WeTransfer, since the beginning of the year. So it's been a nice spike coming from onefingerdiscount.com. So it's great. I'm glad you set it up.
Awesome.
And with Mac Heist, it's actually, I give them a lot of credit. They actually linked to the One Finger Discount from their forums, which I thought was
very classy.
Pretty classy. Yeah, definitely. Especially since at the time they weren't sure if this was meant in a negative way or not. a friend of mine actually, when I tweeted that I had set up the coupon code, sent me a message saying, wow, your hatred of Mac Heist is really, you know, taken on a whole new level. And
yeah.
So, no, that's not what it was meant to be.
People are so primed to see conflict there now that it's like, oh, you know, I really was the last thing from my mind to have something like that. And there's actually one of, you know, most of the press coverage has been really awesome,
mm-hmm.
but one of the blogs that covered it, their headline was literally something like, Mac software promotion gives Mac Heist the finger. And then, you know, is talking about my like vendetta or something. And I'm like, this isn't really, this isn't an accurate reflection.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you conceived of this idea and then implemented it, the coupon, you know, like in an hour. And then by the next morning, you had the site up with at least, you know, a dozen developers, which has only grown. And this can happen sometimes if you just kind of come up with an idea and just not think about it too much, just fire it out there. There might be some weird, you know, issue like this where if you had put it to a focus group, you would have discovered this problem. But if you had put it to a focus group, you may never have shipped this idea to begin with. So
exactly. Yeah. And I'm happy to report that most people have been really, you know, encouraging and seemed to think the idea was pretty cool. And but then, like, out in the wild among the, you know, the blog commenters on, like, the unofficial Apple weblog and some of the others, there's just some really harsh stuff, because, you know, people are like really, really offended by the amateur web design. And I think part of it is they're coming into it thinking that it's like anti-Mac heist. And so then the easiest thing to latch onto is that the web design is like as insanely not good as Mac heist as you could possibly get.
If you start out trying to compete with the Mac heist design and polish, I mean,
no, exactly. Yeah.
You almost might as well keep it real simple and streamlined and not even try to go head to head with that kind of design. Cause they've been spending at least a month probably or more gearing up for this.
Yeah. And I mean, they've got the best designers on the Mac and, you know, working with them. So kudos to them for their awesome design. I mean, it's always awesome. So
yeah, totally.
Anyway, as you said, this is kind of like one of those things where you can just kind of do something, or you can wait and be sort of paralyzed by the fear of doing it wrong. And I have been a victim in the past. You know, most of the time, I would say I am a little too hesitant to do things because I'm afraid of, you know, doing it wrong, or you know, like I'm not the type of person who you know, adds features and then asks questions later about how they're going to work. And you know, I think mostly that attitude has served me well, but there is the flip side, which is, you know, some things that maybe are cool and the public would like, they never end up seeing it because you just like can become so paralyzed with doubt or fear of doing it wrong. So this is a good example of defying that. And I didn't realize it until after, and we were talking about some stuff on chat that I think it was sort of loosely inspired by an interview I heard with Gary Vaynerchuk.
Oh yeah,
you know him, right?
Oh yeah, I'm a big fan.
And he was interviewed on the podcast This Week in Startups, which is a pretty cool Jason Calacanis podcast that I've actually gotten pretty enamored by. You know, he has a particular personality that I guess not everybody enjoys, but I think it's a pretty good show. And he had Gary Vaynerchuk on, and just sort of the mood of it was very inspirational in the way that it was just kind of like, you know, you just kind of do stuff, right? And that's something I think we forget sometimes, is path to success is like a series of steps of just doing something.
Right.
And so I have to, you know, give some credit there, just that this guy, just in his attitude, I think, towards life is partly responsible for motivating me to just kind of like, you know, it kind of like set the stage for me to, I guess, have the reaction to what was, you know, what was going on and put it into something concrete. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. I find a lot to be inspired by from Gary too. I mean, his show Wine Library TV, it's not something I'm so passionate about wine that I need to watch, but I just love his energy. And I think they're, you know, just the fact that he's every day, he's just churning out this stuff. You know, he's done like something like 700, 800 of these podcasts, and they're not all great. I mean, some of them are probably terrible. I mean, I remember watching one where, you know, he's interrupted by somebody in the middle of it, or, you know, something goes wrong. I mean, there's all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
But every single day he churns one of these out, and before you know it, he's done 700 or something. Yeah, he's still doing it.
I've never seen that. I've heard his name a lot, and I've been aware that he's kind of an energetic personality. But I'll have to go check those out now and see, fill in the gaps of my understanding. You know, the reason he was on the show, or, you know, maybe not the reason, but it was coincident with, I guess, he has a book out fairly recently, Crush It.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of interested in that. I wonder if, you know, if I should bother getting it, or whether I should just, you know, take the inspiration I've gotten from him and go with that. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard pretty good things about it. And I skimmed through the sample chapter that he posted. I haven't picked it up yet. I'll probably pick it up at some point, but I'm at a point right now where I've been buying a lot of books that I don't really need to buy. And I'm kind of trying to push back a little bit and focusing just kind of what we were talking about, actually churning out real work instead of just kind of spinning my wheels and watching other people do work and be inspired by other people's work. I think it's easy for me. I don't know about our listeners, but it's easy for me to, if I'm not careful, I just sit and consume other people's great things all day. You know, their funny tweets and their blog posts and their books. And
yeah.
Then at the end of the day, I realize I haven't done anything myself.
Well, that's a good point. Of course, here I am patting myself on the back for actually doing something. And because of doing this, though, it's been like 4 days now since I looked at Xcode or, you know, actually worked on any code. So
yeah,
I gotta get back get the balance back in order here pretty soon. But it's, you know, it's, I guess it all adds up to your life's work or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
well, but I mean, I think the return on investment is great though. I mean, yeah, it kind of, you know, it sucked up a weekend, but you've really, I mean, you spent, let's say 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
On this. And if you just spend 3 or 4 days on pure marketing every few months or every even 6 months and you get this kind of return out of it, I think that's pretty good.
That's a good point.
I mean,
yeah.
You weren't planning on it. You didn't schedule that as marketing time, but I don't know. I think that's pretty fair trade.
I have to remind myself too, it's kind of what's kind of cool in this situation is, you know, it had a positive benefit to me in sales and stuff, but it's also pretty cool that, you know, a bunch of other developers got a positive boost, and then the, you know, the users, the customers seem pretty happy about the discount. So
cool.
We'll just call it a win and move on.
Okay.
You know, speaking of that podcast I mentioned, This Week in Startups, I don't know, have you had a chance to listen to it yet?
You know, I haven't. I've listened to a couple like segments that people have pointed to, but I actually haven't subscribed. So tell me how it is.
Well, I just love, like, you know, I think this guy, Jason Calacanis, I've heard him a few times on Leo Laporte's, you know, podcasts. Like, I think he was on This Week in Tech, and he's this guy that, like Gary Vaynerchuk, I think he has a reputation of intensity. But unlike Gary, I think more people maybe have an impression that it's sort of an unlovable intensity. but I have to say, like, I've listened to maybe three or four episodes now of this podcast, and his irreverence is, like, perfectly suited to me. It's like, he just wants to say F you to everything that's wrong, mm-hmm. You know? And I have happened to agree with a lot of the things he's saying, so it's pretty cool. It's kind of fun, fun stuff. It's very entrepreneur oriented. It's got kind of like some regular segments, which is kind of fun. Like he's got like a Shark Tank segment, which is where some aspiring entrepreneur will call up to the show and like pitch an idea.
Yeah.
And then they give the entrepreneur like 60 seconds or something. And it's just kind of cool. You know, it's good for those of us who are not only, you know, writing code and all that, but also trying to build a business and market stuff and kind of look at the big picture. I think, you know, our listeners who are enjoying the kind of, you know, big picture thinking that goes with that would probably enjoy this. I mean, the episodes run kind of long, so it's easy to see how a lot of people wouldn't have time for it. I mean, I I do a lot of walking and I go to the gym and I always listen to podcasts then. So I end up usually having time to burn through podcasts. But
yeah,
these episodes are like 2 hours long. So
oh,
it,
wow.
it is a little bit long, but you know what? I think I kind of like that too, because I hate people who like apologize for, you know, having too long of a podcast. Like, just turn it off, you know,
right.
if you don't like it. But anyway, it's worth a listen. I think people should check it out. And it's kind of like the amount of irreverence is like enough to kind of make you laugh. But mm-hmm. then he's also kind of got like this sweet sincerity. So I don't know. He's charmed me. He's worth listening to. And I think it's just kind of like a cool example too of somebody who's become successful enough that he can. And for all I know, he was always like, this might be part of his success, but it just seems kind of like he's gotten a level of success where he recognizes that he doesn't have to tiptoe around lots of little things, you know?
Right.
And so that's pretty fun.
Yeah, I like the call-in idea where people are pitching their idea or asking advice and they can shoot it down or whatnot. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
On the flip side of the long podcast. There's a short podcast that just came out. 37 Signals just started doing a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Which I also really like. I don't know if you've... They've only done one episode, but...
I subscribed, but I haven't listened yet. So is it really short?
I think it was like 15 minutes.
Wow. It's like the TED Talk of a podcast.
I mean, we keep ours about 30, which I think is just right. I have a feeling theirs is going to be as short or as long as they want it. But the short kind of fits in with their theme of, you know, less software.
That's true.
Less podcast. But it's also... I like to hear from them and their thinking behind why they make decisions in their products. So I think that's going to be pretty good.
It's great. I love that podcasts are still taking off. Like, you know, you think like it's, you know, podcasts have been around now for years,
mm-hmm.
and you get companies now like 37 Signals, who, like Jason Calacanis, who are just like stepping in, you know, and the content is growing and it's getting better, I think. So
yep.
It's pretty cool.
I think it's great. The more the better, except in the Mac developer market. It's totally saturated. Please don't. No one else jump in.
No more Scotties, please. Okay? We don't need any more Scotties trying to take all of our podcasts. I'm just kidding. I joked with Scotty when he interviewed me for one of his Mac Developer Network podcasts. I joked with him that we were the only non-Scotty podcast. He said that our podcast is his favorite because it's the only one he hasn't already heard a dozen times before it comes out.
That's good. We're the rebellion to his evil empire of Mac developer podcasts.
That's right.
No, I love his stuff.
Yeah, it's great.
I think you did that interview since we last recorded, so we'll link it up in the show notes if people haven't heard it yet. It's pretty good.
Wow, has it really been that long? Amazing.
I think.
So now is when we should have like a punchy segment of the show. We should be like, if this was This Week in Startups, then we would have like some totally unlicensed commercial music come in right now and introduce the next segment, which would be like, you know, would be like, we call it like Tickle Manton or something. Yeah, exactly. So ready for the Tickle Manton scene?
I don't know. That's about all I've got right there.
Oh, boy. I used to be hosted on Pair, you know, PAIR.com,
mm-hmm.
and they're a pretty good company. They've been really stable for me over the past several years. Their stability is largely owing to their sometimes excruciatingly frustrating limitations. They sort of just take the attitude of to have a stable shared hosting environment, we will essentially not let customers do almost anything.
Right.
But if you want to have like a simple PHP-based MySQL, you know, backed website with static pages, it's, you know, reliable and it's pretty good. But this year has been a bad year for me and my love affair with Pear. Just had like a couple incidents where, you know, maybe to their credit, or rather I should say, I guess, to excuse them somewhat, I think what was happening is my usage was sort of going up beyond what was appropriate for my account level. But it started to become kind of arbitrary. Like I'd hit these, like, I don't know, bandwidth or something tripwires, where it wasn't like a sustained problem, but, you know, something like maybe in 1 5-minute period, things spiked and mm-hmm. freaked out their server. And that was fine. You know, I was willing to kind of accept like, okay, I need to, you know, maybe tune my WordPress installation or, you know, fix this or that. But it hit a point of like frustrated, desperation to leave when I actually had like they shut down my site with no warning, and I had to like email them and say like, what do I got to do to get my site back up? It was on this particular day there was no traffic problem. It must have been like a blip in their system or something,
mm-hmm.
and they had no concrete thing for me to do. And they were just like, They kind of gave me like a laundry list of things that might be a problem, mm-hmm. and I was like, well, can you put my site back up and we'll talk about this.
Was it their automated systems that took your site down, or did an actual human intervene. I mean, you'd think they would know.
You'd think they would know, and it was a, I have to say, it was an uncharacteristically robotic type of interaction I had with them. It, they weren't really telling me, but what happened at this point was I had had kind of a couple experiences before this that hinted to me that I wasn't, to be honest, I don't know if Pear has changed or if I just never ran into this angle. I mean, they've always been great for support with me. And they've always been, you know, very like empathetic to like the particular problem going on. In this case, it was just like, they wouldn't even give me a solution that like, you know, like, will it help if I, you know, disable this? Is it a CPU problem? Is it a bandwidth problem? What is it? Right. And, they wouldn't say. So, so that pretty much made me like go into turbo overdrive. As you can imagine, anybody out there listening who's hosting your own site, the last thing you want to happen is for it to be taken down with no warning and with no instruction for how it can be put back.
Yeah.
So it was like, how fast can I get my Slice host? I had already actually signed up for a Slice host because I was experimenting with it. But this turned me into like the world's fastest host migrator.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I discovered that their technique for quote unquote shutting down my site was to just change the permissions on my web hosting directory to not readable. So I sort of said, like, in my support email back to them, like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll figure that out. I'll figure out what to do. And then went myself and changed the permissions to readable. So fortunately, my site was back up. But then I knew that there was this open support issue now. And I knew I was on borrowed time. So that's when I sped over to Slicehost and started getting everything up. And there are some really great things about the Slicehost setup now. It's like, I know a lot of people say, with good reason, they don't want to administer their own site. They don't want to be responsible for all the security updates and all that. But I'm running a very recent version of Ubuntu Linux. And I have to say, this has come a long way. It is shockingly accessible to administer your own Linux web server. And which is not to say that it's completely easy or that it's not frustrating. But what's great is nobody can freaking shut down my site just because they feel like maybe I tripped some resource, you know, barrier. Nobody can make me update to a new version of PHP on a whim with no warning. You know, these are things that happen sometimes in shared environments that you usually survive them, but it's just frustrating when you don't have any control over what's running and it's so critical to your business. So what I'm really excited about now is I control everything, and I guess this sort of goes with my control freak attitude, and it could be dangerous, but it's really cool that I'm able to just say, oh, you know what? This server is only going to have the software I want. It's going to be optimized to serve the kinds of things I want.
It's nice to have that control. I'm kind of, I don't know, I ran my own server for a while. Actually, it was a PowerMax 7500, I think, running PowerPC Linux. And I ran that for years. I just, you know, I'd run into problems like, oh, whoops, spammers are using it as an open relay because I misconfigured something. And you know, I just kept running into things. And so I'm fine letting even bad shared hosts manage my server right now. But it is tempting to have control over.
You say that now, Manton, but you have a couple days when your site is down for a whole day.
Yeah.
And not just now, but imagine when, you know, you're pulling in like $100,000 a day.
That'd be nice.
Right? Because that's going to happen someday. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to be, I don't know if this Dreamhost account is cutting it anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, you're right. And I think I've just been lucky. I mean, you talked about living on borrowed time. I think in a lot of ways, that's me and my shared host. I've been on Dreamhost for a couple years now. And I literally have really acceptable downtime. I would say maybe an hour or two a year, maybe. It's really pretty good for
That's acceptable.
Yeah. That I've noticed, at least, right? But definitely never down all day. I've never had a problem like that. And so it's only a matter of time, probably, until I have an issue. But actually, I wrote a blog post about this a while back called DreamHost Scale. I'm sure if, I think it's the first hit on Google if you search for that, but I'll link it up. Where my theory, and I may be totally wrong, but my theory about DreamHost is, yeah, they have downtime and server problems, but they have them all the time because they have a kajillion servers. And because they have so many servers, they're actually really, really good at automating fixing problems and rebuilding servers. So if something does die, they lose a hard drive or a router or whatever, the theory is they can rebuild the server or replace it, like, you know, in half an hour. Whereas it's, in a lot of cases, it's difficult for other people, especially other cheap shared hosts, to be able to recover from those kind of things. So that's a theory. I don't know if it's right or not, but like I said, I've been really lucky. It's funny though, I'm not, it's, I say, I called it a cheap shared host. I'm actually paying probably more than a comparable slice host for what I'm using. Cause I noticed actually a few days ago, my wife was looking through finances and she said, what's this $55 charge from DreamHost? I'm like, $55? Yeah, that can't be right. And I only pay $19, right? But it actually adds up pretty quickly because of IP addresses and SSL certificates and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever, so.
That's interesting, yeah. That's another thing. I had to pay Pear $10 a month for the privilege of hosting a secure site.
Right.
You know, that's not the cost for the certificate. That's like for opening up the pipe to the HTTPS version. Anyway, yeah. I'm in a bad mood about Pear right now, but it's obviously I had a lot of good years with them, but I was, you know, I always used to say, you know, they nickel and dime you, you can't do anything, and but at least the site's always up.
Right.
And obviously when I couldn't say at least the site's always up anymore, it was time to move on.
Yep. Makes sense. Well, good luck with the new setup. It sounds like it's working pretty well so far. So we're going to take a listener question. This one comes from Andrew Skinner. He says, I was wondering if you might consider discussing including open source content and binaries in applications in a future podcast. For example, I know that Manton uses Parian in Clipstart. What are the things to consider when doing this, et cetera, et cetera? So good question. And you've recently wrote about open source licenses, in particular the GPL and how you kind of got to stay away from it as a commercial developer. I think we've talked about that before, but
yeah,
this is,
we've touched on it. That's the main. If you ask me, that's the main thing. Is well, there's two main things, and they're connected to each other. The first thing is, can you comply with the terms of the license of whatever source code you want to use, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, you probably don't want to comply with the terms of the GPL, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Most of us, if you're selling commercial software, people like to are quick to point out you can have GPL software and sell it, and that's fine. There's nothing anti-commercial about the GPL. But if you put GPL code in your project, you are agreeing to the terms of the GPL, meaning that you will provide source code to your application. So I hope Parian isn't GPL.
It is LGPL.
LGPL.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, and yeah, as he says in Clipstart, I use Parian. I also use another LGPL QuickTime component. The name is escaping me, but it's for conversion to, one of the new video Aug Forbis format that I can't remember the name.
Yeah, the LGPL, to be honest, it still scares me a little bit because the whole question of, you know, what people... I've noticed that the Free Software Foundation, at least, is, of course, because they're fighting for, you know, openness and freeness of software, they're going to try to make the most limiting interpretation of LGPL as they can, right? And they say things that sort of make you think that they would consider, I don't know. You know, it's not fresh in my mind, but there's things I've read about LGPL that make me think, okay, it's not as safe as like a BSD or MIT license, but it's still pretty safe.
Yeah, it's usually okay if you're careful. I'm a little extra careful. I think we've talked about this before, but the way I treat LGPL, and I never do GPL, but the way I treat LGPL is I treat it as if I'm treating the GPL code, even though you technically can link to LGPL code as a shared library. I don't. I always make sure it's completely separate. So
you go through a tool?
I've changed how I do things a little bit in Clipstart, and we transfer. I do a bunch of video stuff, and some of the video stuff I use QuickTime for. And actually, this was before QtKit was actually any good. So there's a lot of like Carbon, sort of old school QuickTime code in it. And I use that for some things. And then for other things, I call into FFmpeg, which is a command line tool inside the app that I ship. So it's completely separate. And there's a couple other little command line tools in WeTransfer, which I call out and run processes in the background for doing things. That worked fine in Clipstart. Since I was 10.5 and later, I decided to use QtKit for everything. And so instead of having command line tools, although I do have some command line tools for a couple pieces that I've written myself that I want to just completely churn out and I don't want to deal with threading. But for everything else, I've used QtKit and then QuickTime components. So Parian is a QuickTime component, and this other one that the name is escaping me is a QuickTime component. And then I just, if the QuickTime component is not installed on the user's machine yet, so I check to see if it's installed, then I load it inside the app. And that's actually worked out pretty well. But I think there's good reasons to use either one, having a command line tool or not.
Well, one thing that's nice about the command line approach, especially when it comes to stuff like what you're doing with this processing, I've done some stuff like that too, where command line tools are used to sort of access this processing code, and it kind of insulates your app from the possibility that there are crashing bugs in that code, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely.
Aside from the LGPL stuff, there's some really popular open source packages in Mac development, like Sparkle for software updating. That's a MIT license, I think, so it's pretty liberal and safe to use. And what else? Anything else you use? I'm trying to think.
Let me think. There's a bunch of little MIT BSD kind of just like little source files here and there that I'll pull in.
Yeah.
That someone's written, not big packages, but like someone's written some category on.
Right. Or like a RB split view from Rainer Brockerhoff. That's a pretty popular alternative to NS split view. It kind of handled, I think NS split view is caught up now, but it sort of handled a lot of the little nuanced things better than NS split view for many years.
Yeah. I used to use RB split view and loved it. And then when the new IB came out and they broke IB plugins, I sort of swore off anything that had a custom IB palette.
Yeah.
And so I forced myself to use the built-in NS split view, which, as you said, is way better in 10.5. They've actually added some new hooks. And it's kind of, maybe I was going overboard, because there's some really good open source IB stuff that I'd like to use. Some of the custom,
like BW Toolkit.
Yeah,
right?
That's the one.
Brandon Walken. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's cool stuff, but I've kind of got burned on the whole IB plugin thing. Because the problem for people that haven't run into it is if you use a plugin in IB and then you go to a different machine that doesn't have it installed or, you know, whatever. It's a pain. And then you end up with these nib files that you can't open. And so in all my new projects, they're totally,
I'm with you.
It's totally separate, but it is compelling. And I know for some of these, and I think RB split view is this way. I think you can instantiate it in code.
Yeah, that's what I do, actually. I have to admit, though, it was really kind of a pain to figure out how to do it all right. It was nuanced. But I had to do it. I didn't have to do it, but I chose to do it that way because I was sort of sneaking it in as a replacement in Mars Edit, and I didn't want to deal. You know how hairy it can be when you go into an existing nib and you want to suddenly like put everything into a new subview. Like,
oh, yeah.
You're like, I'm going to lose connections. I think it's gotten better in recent interface builders, but at the time I was just like, you know what, this is crazy. I'm just going to, you know, install it at runtime. So it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because I didn't run into that plugin problem at all.
Cool.
And it was just lucky for me that I had, for different reasons, needed to do it in code.
Great. Well, I hope that answers your question, Andrew. And if not, send us another one and we'll talk about it some more. Right now, I don't think you can really avoid, for a lot of apps, using some open source software. So I think this is something that continues to come up for people, just because there's some great stuff out there where,
yeah,
if you reinvented the...
And you should use it. I mean, come on. It's especially the stuff that's liberally licensed with MIT or BSD licenses. There's no reason not to. The main risk in using open source software, in my opinion, is you didn't write it, so you don't have a good sense for how risky the code itself might be. You're sort of taking it for granted that it's not going to erase the user's hard disk or something.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a really good point. And I got bit by this in a WeTransfer maybe about a year ago. At the time, FFmpeg, they didn't sort of have official releases. Like, here's a stable release called, it's open source software, so it's going to be like 0.75, right? But so you just basically you pulled down the trunk and you tested it and hopefully it worked. And so what I would do every once in a while is I would pull in the latest version. Maybe I wouldn't do it every bug fix release, but I would do it every maybe 6 months. And I would test it and hopefully it worked fine. But there was one time where I pulled down the trunk, I built it, it seemed to work, and I shipped it, and there was some weird bug with certain audio formats that totally broke. And so I started getting, these customer reports. I'm like, what?
Right.
Googled around a little bit and figured out that it had recently been fixed, and so I could pull in the fix. But there is definitely a risk with using someone else's code, especially something that complex.
Yeah.
Such a large project. You never know if they're going to break something in your app.
Yeah, I usually keep snapshots of... we should talk about this sometime, because it's its own topic, keeping projects in sync with each other.
Yeah,
but I keep my I keep a snapshot for the open source projects I use, so that I have a copy checked into my own version control, and then I just sort of have to periodically, merge in their latest changes if I want them. So
yeah. I actually do exactly the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it can be kind of a pain to keep things synced up, and some of the version control tools are better at it than others. But it's nice in that you don't get all the new features the minute that they're out there, but you also don't take any of the new bugs. So it's a good compromise.
Cool.
All right, well, let's keep this recording thing going, Manton. Try and crank out some more episodes.
Sounds good. Well, I'll talk to you next time.
Awesome.
Bye.
Bye.